Artificial intelligence seems like it's here to stay. The Chinese government is not taking any chances. It's moving to regulate things like AI chatbots.
The Chinese government is instinctively paranoid about anything that could be perceived as a threat to their power.
Also today in southern Turkey, victims of February's massive earthquakes have lost homes and loved ones. But life goes on, woman tells us, because it must. And it's been 25 years since a peace agreement in Northern Ireland mostly ended years of sectarian fear and bloodshed.
There was always that continuing underlying feeling of threat and violence, but that's gone.
Although the legacy of the so-called Troubles has not totally disappeared. Those stories and much more today here on The World. You're listening to The World. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Marco Werman. And this is my news presenter counterpart in Kuwait.
أنا فضة.
Her name is فدا.
أول مذيعة في الكويت تعمل بالذكاء الاصطناعي في مؤسسة كويت نيوز الإعلامية.
In this clip on Twitter, فدا is explaining that she's the first artificial intelligence news presenter at Kuwait News. In other words, فدا is not a real person. Kuwait News has just introduced her in a test run, adding broadcast journalists to the list of people concerned about AI competing for their jobs. In a recent study, Goldman Sachs suggested AI could end up replacing the equivalent of some 300 million jobs. Feda, the AI newscaster in Kuwait, is another reminder that rapidly our world is embracing artificial intelligence. We want to spend the first part of today's show looking at two examples of how AI has picked up speed, one potentially troubling scenario, the other encouraging. First to China, where the government is proposing new rules for AI so that it doesn't, as they put it, subvert state power. This comes as leading Chinese tech companies are racing each other to develop something like ChatGPT, and e-commerce giant Alibaba just released a new AI chatbot called Tongyi Chenwen. To learn more about this move for state control, we called up Jeremy Goldcorn, editor-in-chief of the independent news site The China Project. Jeremy, when Chinese authorities say they don't want AI to subvert state power, what exactly does that mean?
Well, they've essentially applied the same rules to generative AI technology that apply to all internet companies and to all media companies. So they've made all kinds of things illegal, including, you know, some things that one may think are admirable, such as discrimination on the basis of race or gender or country of origin. But they've also made things illegal that we might look a little differently at them in the United States from in China, such as subverting state power.
And just briefly, generative AI is what?
Generative AI is artificial intelligence that can produce words or visual art using prompts.
Got it. So is the Chinese central government worried, for example, that AI could tell people about what happened at Tiananmen Square, something that government censorship in China has worked diligently for years to blot out, or something more organized and targeted?
I think both of those things. I think the obvious and, you know, most immediate worry is that the AI will talk about historical events, recent history, or politics in a way that the Chinese government doesn't like, which has already figured out a very good way of censoring everything else that goes on the internet. But I think the worry is just of, you know, a general worry, like everybody around the world, of, you know, nobody really understands where this technology is going.
Yeah, like maybe you can sketch out some of the subtle threats that China's Communist Party could be worried about.
Well, the censorship in China is extremely deep. So, for example, it extends to something they call historical nihilism, which is essentially any suggestion that the Communist Party isn't, you know, the best and the best leader of the country, and that the Communist Party has ever done anything wrong. Anything that could lead to doubts among the populace that Xi Jinping should be the leader and that the Communist Party should be leading the country.
So how exactly would regulation of AI work? I mean, is it about looking at the programmer's code into the software before it's released into the world?
Well, these are draft regulations that were released today. They're available actually for public comment until May the 10th. This year, and then presumably at some point after that, a final version will actually become law. And in some ways, it's quite vague, but it basically holds the company responsible for all of the content. So you mentioned earlier Alibaba's Tongyi Qianwen, and you know the other perhaps most famous one currently in China is ErnieBot by the search giant Baidu, and the you know the AI company SenseTime has also released a chatbot. So these three companies, for example, any what the Chinese government considers negative results from their AI, they will be held responsible for. There are also provisions in the law that say that the training materials used to train the AI bots must be pre-censored.
Wow.
What these rules essentially do is they give the government a way to criminalize anything that they don't like after it's happened. If the AI bot starts spitting out anti-government slogans, the company responsible for it will be held accountable.
That's incredible. How does Alibaba's chatbot compare with, say, ChatGPT?
I have not used it yet. We have done a story on ErnieBot, which is the first one that was released just about a month ago, I guess, by Baidu. They haven't caught up with ChatGPT. And one of the problems they have is that there's a paucity of source materials, the training materials, particularly when it comes to, for example, scientific research. The vast majority of the world's scientific research is written up in English language.
Do you think this legal danger for companies like Alibaba in China could end up stymieing their progress in AI technology?
It could. It seems that it is, of course, you know, a huge limitation on this type of technology if you are restricting the materials that it is allowed to learn from. What I would say is that, you know, for many years it was conventional wisdom that because of censorship, China would not be able to innovate technologically. And if the last 10 or 15 years of Chinese tech development have taught us anything, it's that it is still possible to innovate even, you know, in a highly censored environment. So I wouldn't write the Chinese AI companies off just yet because of censorship. Mm. In the past, the conventional wisdom has not turned out to be accurate.
Jeremy Goldkorn, editor-in-chief of the China Project. Thanks very much. Really appreciate your insights.
Thank you, Marco. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
AI may be seen as a threat by many governments and individuals, but here's a potential positive contribution from the field. Researchers are training computers to recognize medical conditions. AI-based diagnostic systems proved useful during the pandemic.
For example, here is a cough of a healthy individual.
This recording comes from a 2020 study at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
And now here is a cough of an asymptomatic person with COVID-19.
Yeah, really hard to tell the difference, but MIT's AI system could. It identified asymptomatic COVID infections with 100% accuracy. Here's another example. This is a recording from a project in Australia developing an AI to detect Parkinson's disease. The AI listens for abnormal variations in the voice that fit the disease profile. In London, at Imperial College, Bjorn Schuller is a professor of artificial intelligence. His lab teaches computers to recognize certain features of diseases.
We tell it to listen to the pitch. So how high is your voice? Like very high or very low?
And now he says an AI can train itself to recognize many health conditions. One final bit of news, labs in India and Germany this month show that their AI had been trained to detect the common cold accurately 70% of the time. Might make calling in sick to work more complicated someday. If claiming a cold is too risky, there's always the old standby, food poisoning. In southern Turkey, thousands of people are living in tents among the ruins of their former homes. It's been 2 months since earthquakes killed more than 57,000 people in Turkey and Syria. The disaster left an estimated 1.5 million people homeless and countless buildings unsafe to live or work in. And that's meant communities across southern Turkey have had to figure out how to live outdoors. Families are determined to stay where they're from. The world's Duri Baskaran reports from the devastated city of Antakya.
Every day, Elçin Ezer walks from her container home in a park to the pile of rubble that used to be the home she shared with her two children. I always used to walk here with my kids, she says. Now I walk alone. Azair's apartment building collapsed during that first early morning earthquake on February 6th. She survived underneath the wreckage for 4 days, hugging her daughter as she died in her arms. Her mother and her son were in the next room, but she never heard their voices. She thinks they both died on impact. People ask me why I came back, she says, and I don't know what to tell them. My legs brought me here on their own. Antakya today is a city of grief. As you drive down from the hills, there's a dusty haze settling over the ruins of buildings as crews tear down wrecked apartments that are still somehow standing upright. The Turkish government has promised to rebuild earthquake-damaged cities within the year, but with 1.5 million people now homeless, that seems impossible. In the city, debris is cleared and packed onto trucks, which are driven out of town and dumped along the highway. Tall mechanical lifts line up to the rickety husks of apartment buildings as people salvage furniture from their damaged homes. Climbing up into these apartment blocks is dangerous work, but it pays well. Anas Sahir, a Syrian refugee, says he sent his wife and children to another city to live far from the risk of aftershocks. He stayed behind to work. But every night, his kids cry on the phone, asking him to come for them. The staircase of their building collapsed when they were trying to escape their home, he says. He had a head injury, and his mother had to be hospitalized. He's just grateful they survived.
Alhamdulillah. Thank God for everything.
In Antakya's city center, a line of vans offers some small daily comforts. Fresh baklava, a mobile ATM, a phone store. Sami Joba chops onions for kebabs, which he's grilling on a charcoal stove. He lost his restaurant in the earthquake, but he and a friend converted an old school bus so they could sell hot food to survivors living in tent cities.
It was cheap. I think a nice taste. Yeah. And we don't have anywhere to cooking now.
Salma Koshar waits with her 12-year-old son. They're living in a tent nearby. My son is doing better than before, she says. But right after the earthquake, he wouldn't speak and he couldn't eat.
Is this the first time you've had a kebab since the earthquake?
Yes, it is, Salma tells me. They've been eating donated soup and beans for weeks. So when her son got excited about a kebab, she couldn't say no, even though she couldn't afford one for herself. Other families have moved to the hills, where villages ring the outskirts of old Antakya. Perihan Yüksek uses a match to light a propane stove in a makeshift tent that serves as a kitchen. She came here after the earthquakes to be with her cousin, Bedia Yüksek, who's mourning the loss of her daughter, Hulia. Whenever I'm in the tent, it feels like the pain is going to kill me, Bedia says. Her daughter was sleeping in her apartment in Antakya when the earthquake hit. Perhan's son, who was also living nearby, survived, but lost both of his legs. Here in the hills outside the city, the Yüksek's home is still standing, but it looks like it could collapse at any moment. Bedia and her husband set up donated tents in the garden, where they sleep. A photograph of their late daughter sits next to the television, watching over them. Life continues because it has to, Perihan says. Life goes on until God takes it from us. Days are spent washing clothes by hand, cooking outdoors, and making improvements to the tents so they stay dry in the rain. They eat eggs from their chickens and oranges from their garden. But they're determined to stay until their home is rebuilt. It's like going back in time, Perihan says over a glass of tea. As she finishes her cup, she flings the extra out onto the dirt floor. I guess that's something, she says. If there's no money, there's nothing to clean. For The World, I'm Derya Buzgarin in Antakya, Turkey.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. There is drought, and then there's drought that prompts an official visit from the UN Secretary General.
Somalia is experiencing its worst series of 5 years of drought in recorded history.
That's Antonio Guterres, who is in Somalia today. Drought is not a new problem in Somalia. The UN has tried to deal with it several times over the past decade, but it is a persistent one. In 2022 alone, some 43,000 Somalis died from drought-related causes. Herders have lost millions of their livestock. Across the country, farmers have seen their precious crops die off. Nearly 5 million people in Somalia are facing acute food insecurity, according to the UN. Thousands of displaced people have left their homes and moved toward the capital, Mogadishu, where they're living in temporary settlements, hoping for better access to food and water. It is a tough situation, especially during the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. Many Somalis are now breaking their daily fast with limited access to food and water, relying on aid groups just to get by. Climate change is one big factor behind what's playing out in Somalia. Here's Antonio Guterres again, talking about that earlier today.
Although Somalia makes virtually no contribution to climate change, the Somalis are among the greatest victims.
Guterres says that Somalia contributes 0.003% of global emissions related to climate change. Decades of conflict make the situation worse. There is a military offensive underway right now against al-Shabaab militants, which has led to even more displacement. The fighting makes it difficult for aid workers to provide desperately needed assistance. Looking ahead, the Secretary General said he hopes that next rainy season will finally bring some relief from the years of drought. Today, a court in South Africa began hearing arguments in a case that could decide the fates of tens of thousands of Zimbabweans living in the country. Some 160,000 migrants and their dependents have special temporary residency status in South Africa. It's set to run out in June. For more on what this could mean, we turn to Lauren Landau, a professor at Oxford University and researcher at the African Center for Migration and Society in Johannesburg. Lauren, what brought these Zimbabweans to South Africa in the first place, and why do they have this special residency status?
Zimbabweans have been coming to South Africa for generations, but this group came particularly in the early 2000s as Zimbabwe collapsed economically, and many of them were there looking for refugee status, looking for ways to stay and make a living. South Africa didn't want to give them refugee status. South Africa didn't want to let them stay permanently. So this was what they came up with. They got this special permit. It was supposed to last for just a couple of years, but now it's gone on for almost 15.
So in court, starting today, holders of these permits are suing to extend their stay in South Africa. What is their argument?
The argument is that there's now almost a whole generation of people who have been born in South Africa or have made their lives in South Africa, that conditions in Zimbabwe have not improved substantially, and that many of them have nothing there to go back to. So the argument is around a procedural issue, that there wasn't enough consultation, and that South African government hasn't offered them the alternatives that it needs to offer them before taking away this status.
I mean, it sounds very much like temporary protected status here in the U.S. It is not permanent. At some point when things in the country of origin improve, the protection is lifted. Why is the government saying it does not want to build in another extension to the permits for the Zimbabweans like it has in the recent past?
Well, you're absolutely right. This was intended as a temporary program. And right now we're looking at an election coming up, the party elections this year, the sort of primaries, the national elections next year. There is widespread anti-immigration sentiment across the political spectrum in South Africa. The government doesn't want to be seen as being friendly towards immigrants, doesn't want to be seen particularly as giving immigrants the right to work in the country when unemployment is so, so high. So it's a political football, and unfortunately these Zimbabweans and many of the people who depend on them are going to pay the price.
So for people in South Africa who support letting the special status of the Zimbabweans end, what do they see as the hoped-for benefit?
Well, there's a lot of demonization of immigrants in South Africa, a lot of blaming them for unemployment rates that are 30, 40, 50%, depending on how you calculate it, for crime, for a whole range of other things, even the political corruption somehow blamed on immigrants. So the hope is, of course, that if we get rid of these people, conditions will improve for South Africans. This is a relatively small number of people. They're an important group, but of course, getting rid of them is not going to make the difference that people hope for.
What kind of jobs do those Zimbabweans who are benefiting from this temporary protected status, what kind of jobs do they hold in South Africa?
Zimbabweans are in almost all sectors of South African society at this point. They've been there, as I said, for generations. the nice thing about and the important thing about this status is it allows them to work in the professions. And many of them are in medical fields, and there are many of them are in teaching positions.
Right. So let's say the residency protection is lifted. Won't South Africans be able to fill those jobs?
South Africa has a massive skills gap right now due to a failing public education system and especially an unwillingness of people to work in rural areas, especially hospitals and schools. So there is a skills gap right now. Zimbabweans in various sectors are helping to fill that gap and investing in businesses and creating other jobs. So yes, it might create some jobs for South Africans, but what the employers are worried about is that it's going to create gaps that can't be filled.
I mentioned some 160,000 people have these permits, but their dependents are also in South Africa now. How many people in total will really be impacted if the permits expire?
It's hard to know exactly how many. We don't have data on every one of the families and their friends, or rather their family members. But it's clear that they have family in South Africa, children, dependents, and perhaps more importantly, they have extended family back in Zimbabwe who are relying heavily on money and goods sent back to Zimbabwe to keep themselves alive as that country continues to struggle economically.
Lauren, how much is nationalism contributing to the current push in South Africa to lift this residency protection for Zimbabweans?
Over the last 20 years, we've seen a hardening of attitudes towards immigrants among the South African population. It used to be on the fringes. It's now at the center of politics. It is something that every politician in South Africa promises to get rid of foreigners, to make jobs for South Africans, to close the borders. I don't think we can separate nationalism from what's going on here, and it makes it very unlikely that we're going to see a long-term solution or substantive, sensible, and pragmatic immigration reform.
It's kind of curious, isn't it? Because frontline states like Zimbabwe and Mozambique were critical to the push against apartheid and ultimately getting it lifted.
Zimbabwe played a very important role for that, and members of the ruling party took refuge in Zimbabwe during the war and even organized their armed insurrection from Zimbabwe. More importantly, the region is really integrated economically, and a stronger Zimbabwe, stronger Mozambique, stronger neighboring countries means more trade for South Africa, a stronger labor market, stronger opportunities. And yet, as we've seen in the U.S., as we've seen elsewhere in the world, some of these arguments don't seem to hold when politics is at stake.
Lauren Landau is a researcher with the African Center for Migration and Society in Johannesburg and a professor at Oxford University. Lauren, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. New anti-gay legislation in Uganda is stoking fears of similar laws passing in other African countries like Ghana. Officials there use potent language to drive voters to the polls.
It's only politicians that are making these statements. So politicians really use LGBT people as pawns.
And the UK wants residents to give up smoking and switch to vaping instead. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of PRX and GBH in Boston. President Biden visits Belfast in Northern Ireland today. It is the start of a four-day presidential visit that coincides with the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. The 1998 deal aimed to bring an end to 3 decades of violence in the British territory. Just yesterday, though, police were attacked during a street parade in the city of Derry. Authorities have also raised the terrorism threat level in the region to severe. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has more.
Alan McBride, who's from Belfast, remembers exactly where he was when George Mitchell, the US senator, made this announcement on the 10th of April in 1998.
I'm pleased to announce that the two governments and the political parties of Northern Ireland have reached agreement.
Came out of a picture house, actually, with a friend, and we turned the radio on and we heard all the commotion and the fun, and we kind of knew it was historic.
That historic deal was signed at Stormont Castle, where George Mitchell and all the leaders of the main political parties across Ireland and the United Kingdom had been holed up for days. So Alan McBride jumped in his car and headed to Stormont.
I mean, everybody was there. The media, the world's media was there. I mean, I've never seen so many cameramen in Stormont in all my life.
McBride had campaigned in favour of the Good Friday Agreement, but he's not a politician. He was raised in a staunchly unionist, meaning pro-British, household in Belfast. His father was a member of the UDA, a loyalist paramilitary group. But on October 23rd in 1993, everything changed for Alan McBride.
The Shankill Road was crowded with the usual Saturday lunchtime shoppers. The bomb exploded without warning. It ripped through the fishmonger's shop and the building on either side. The emergency services were quickly on the scene. Minutes later, the bodies started to come out.
Among the 9 civilians killed that day was McBride's wife, Sharon, who was 29. The Irish Republican Army claimed responsibility for the bombing. The militant group said it was targeting a meeting of members of the Ulster Defence Association above the fish shop, but no such meeting was taking place. For a long time, McBride says, he just felt fury against the IRA bombers and the Republican Party Sinn Féin. But some years later, he went to university, and there, McBride says, he began meeting people from the Irish nationalist community. He says he noticed just how alike the two sides really were, and he came to a realisation.
I knew that the only thing that was going to make any difference was if we reached some kind of an agreement, and to do that, unfortunately, you had to talk to the people that were waging the war.
McBride now runs a victim support group in Belfast. He says the Good Friday Agreement, in many ways, was a success. It largely brought peace to the region. Steve Aiken, a former leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, agrees. He says there's just no comparison between now and the bad old days.
And every time I came home, I would check under my car for a sort of booby-trap bombs. I was always very cautious about where I went and who I spoke to. I felt, you know, there was always that continuing underlying feeling of threat and violence, but that's gone.
But not entirely. Just a few weeks ago, John Caldwell, an off-duty police detective, was shot in the town of Omagh.
After coaching an under-15 football team at this sports complex, he was putting footballs into his car when he was attacked and shot multiple times by 2 gunmen in front of his young son.
A group calling itself the New IRA claimed responsibility. And just yesterday, during a march marking the 1916 uprising in Derry, a small crowd threw Molotov cocktails at an armoured police van. The parade was led by more than a dozen people dressed in paramilitary-style gear. But Steve Aiken says most of the violence these days has actually very little to do with politics.
Quite a few what I would call narco-terrorists are quite happy to add a name of some political grouping to try and justify what is essential their criminality. And it is very largely criminal.
Many young people in Northern Ireland today have grown up in a world that's very different from that of their parents. But some experts say the legacy of those decades of violence has trickled down through the generations.
So in Northern Ireland, we know that today's young people, all of whom were born after the Good Friday Agreement and the ceasefires, are 25% more likely to have a mental health issue than anywhere else on these islands.
That's Kuala Yasuma, the former Children's Commissioner in Northern Ireland, speaking to the BBC recently. Yasuma says the lack of a functioning government at Stormont isn't helping matters either. The DUP, it's the largest unionist party in the region, pulled out of government last May in a dispute over post-Brexit trading arrangements. Steve Aiken, who's a member of the government, says not having a functioning assembly is damaging Northern Ireland, both politically and economically.
We should have been up and running. President Biden should have had the opportunity to talk to the combined assembly. And we should be able to push Northern Ireland's a great place to do investment in. And, you know, that's a missed opportunity.
In fact, President Biden is spending only one evening in Northern Ireland. The White House says Biden will give a speech tomorrow about what it calls the tremendous progress made in the region since the Good Friday Agreement. But most of the president's visit will take place across the border in the south, celebrating his Irish roots. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
The British government has an ambitious plan to be smoke-free by 2030. Part of that plan is a campaign called Swap to Stop. It aims to get smokers in the UK to switch from tobacco cigarettes to e-cigarettes. We thought that was interesting given how controversial e-cigarettes are here in the US. So we reached out to an expert on addiction and smoking cessation. Jamie Hartman-Boyce is a professor of evidence-based policy and practice at Oxford University. So, Jamie, this Swap to Stop campaign will offer up to 1 million British smokers a free vaping starter kit to help wean them off tobacco. What do you think of that approach?
I think it is a welcome development here. We have really good quality evidence now that offering people who smoke e-cigarettes as a way to help them quit smoking can work. It's one of the best tools we have to help people quit smoking. And now this is really an endorsement by the government, which we know has already been encouraging use of these, but it's going to put more of them in the people's hands who will benefit from them.
Yeah, what is the evidence that vaping is an effective way for people trying to kick the habit? I mean, isn't it just another nicotine delivery system?
It's another nicotine delivery system, but I think one of the confusing things in this area is that nicotine has a really bad name for itself. And to some extent, that's right. It should have a bad name for itself. It's what gets people hooked on smoking. But it's not the thing in cigarettes that causes the cancer and heart disease and lung disease that we've all heard so much about. And for decades now, people have been using nicotine replacement therapy in the form of things like patches and gum to help them safely quit smoking. E-cigarettes are another way to deliver nicotine without all the harm that comes from burning tobacco.
In the U.S., as you know, vaping has a pretty bad reputation for a number of reasons. But one of the key ones is that e-cigarette companies have aggressively marketed them to teenagers, in effect, getting teens hooked on nicotine. And many of those teens never smoked cigarettes in the first place. Is that same concern in the U.K.?
That's definitely a concern here as well. It's something that, you know, in the announcement today, as well as introducing this new scheme, they're introducing tougher measures to really crack down on youth vaping and on disposable e-cigarettes in particular. But just because something is bad for one population or one group doesn't mean it can't be helpful towards another. And I think one of the problems with e-cigarettes is that people are so inclined to either talk about them as good or bad. But if you're someone who isn't at risk of smoking, doesn't smoke, then e-cigarettes are not going to be much of a benefit to you. If you're someone who does smoke or someone who lives with someone who smokes, then e-cigarettes might actually stand to improve your health.
Another part of Britain's Swap to Stop campaign that caught my attention, it's going to offer a choice of e-cigarettes at varying strength and flavor. Again, in the U.S., a flavoring of e-cigarettes, critics say, is a pernicious way to appeal to kids. What's your view on offering different flavors?
I think it's a really tricky one. We know from kind of interviews and various research in adults who've successfully used e-cigarettes to help them quit smoking that a lot of them do like a range of different flavors, and particularly things that don't necessarily taste like cigarettes, right? Because what they're trying to do is get off of cigarettes. But also, if we look at some of the flavors that are out there, they're clearly marketed to very young people. And so I think there's probably a balance to be found in making sure that we have enough flavors available to help adults quit smoking, but are really cracking down on those which are clearly designed to deliberately attract kids.
I remember in the early 2000s, the UK also took this unprecedented path in an attempt to reduce cigarette consumption, introducing picture warnings on cigarette packs or pictures of rotting teeth or a baby smoking cigarettes, implying that that's what happens when a pregnant person or young mother smokes. What is it about the UK and these aggressive no-smoking campaigns? Do they work?
They have worked, and we see them kind of all over the world working. So smoking is a really tricky thing to combat, but it's also an absolutely vital one to combat. It is the leading cause of preventable death and disease worldwide. And anyone who has smoked, or most people who have smoked, know it can be really, really difficult to stop smoking. People are working against the tobacco industry who's exists to help them keep smoking. And so what we need is a toolkit of options and a toolkit of ways that can work synergistically together to help people quit and stop people from starting. And what we've done in the UK is we've gradually implemented quite a lot of these to help crack down. And our smoking rates are now the lowest they've ever been, but we want them to go even lower still.
Jamie, how will you gauge the success of the Swap to Stop program? How soon do you think we could see results?
You know, in the studies that we have looked at where people are given e-cigarettes to help them stop smoking, what we like to see is people not smoking at 6 months or longer. That gives us a lot of reassurance that things are working because after that point, they're less likely to go back to smoking. Of course, these things take time to roll out and tracking them will always be a little bit of a challenge and isolating their impact when we see a lot of other things. But hopefully what we'll see is we'll see the trend in smoking to continue to go down. What we also want to see is that young people who wouldn't have otherwise smoked aren't starting to vape. So there's a lot of monitoring that needs to be done around there too. Here in the UK and throughout the world, there's a lot of misunderstandings about e-cigarettes. So it's also, I suppose, a hope of mine as someone who looks at the evidence on this a lot and tries to communicate it, that the UK government's clear communication around e-cigarettes will help clarify the groups for whom they stand to be beneficial.
Jamie Hartmann-Boyce is an expert on addiction and smoking cessation at Oxford University. She's been speaking to us from Oxford, England, about the new Swap to Stop program aimed at giving cigarette smokers in the UK vaping kits. Jamie, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
There are 67 countries in the world with laws that criminalize homosexuality. Nearly half are in Africa. Uganda in East Africa recently passed one such law, sparking outrage and condemnation from many around the globe. Now advocates are worried Uganda's anti-gay law may serve as a model for other African countries. That includes Ghana in West Africa, which has been considering similar legislation since 2021. From the capital Accra, Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports.
Michael is 27 years old and gay. When he came out as a teenager, his parents disowned him and threatened to poison him. Michael, whose surname I cannot reveal for safety reasons, then relocated to Accra. But even here, he says life is not easy, especially in the wake of proposed anti-LGBTQ legislation in Ghana.
Now I find it difficult to go to town and even just be myself, because you don't know who would suspect you of being gay or lesbian and probably lynch you or do anything harmful to you, because now the homophobia is so high.
The law will see LGBTQ people and their advocates face jail terms. LGBTQ people would also be forced into so-called conversion therapy, a practice attempting to change a person's sexual orientation that is widely condemned globally. The bill even calls on Ghanaians to report those they suspect of being gay to the police. Like many LGBTQ people here, Michael is afraid and wants to flee Ghana before the bill is passed.
We cannot even live in this country anymore, because the bill will ignite so much hate and homophobia that even getting a job will be difficult, not to talk of getting a place to live or to rent for yourself.
Being LGBTQ is illegal in more than half of the countries in Africa, with four countries enforcing the death penalty. In Uganda's recent law, the penalties became more stringent.
We are making this law for our children. We are making this law for the children of our children. This country will stand firm. And once it passed, I can tell you, Madam Speaker, we are going to reinforce the law enforcement officers to make sure that homosexuals have no space in Uganda.
The bill, which imposes the death penalty, will now be sent to President Yoweri Museveni to sign into law. Robert Akoto Amwafo is a Ghanaian human rights advocate who just returned from a human rights conference in Uganda.
I'm sad and concerned and mainly about the LGBT community in Uganda, about the impact of this bill on their daily lives, and especially for those who have come out as LGBT people who are known by their community.
But the Uganda anti-gay law seems to have resonated well with some African leaders. Ghana's Speaker of Parliament, Alban Bagbin, in a recent meeting with MPs, urged them to take inspiration from Uganda.
Our friends just passed their law in Uganda, so we have to do that. And so what are you afraid of? Don't be intimidated by any person.
Akoto Amwafo says this is all very political.
In Uganda, in Ghana, in Kenya, in Mali, in Niger, it's only politicians that are making these statements. And of course, politicians who see this as an opportunity to make more numbers for their votes.
Some analysts say this may be only part of the reasons. They argue that many on the continent see anti-gay laws as some of the surest ways to safeguard African traditional values and culture, and also discourage moral decadence in many African societies. Henry Ikenna Ogu is a human rights activist based in Nigeria.
So as long as traditional and cultural values continue to shape public discourse, it will be difficult for LGBT individuals to gain full acceptance and protection under the law.
Many of these laws originate from colonial times. out of the 53 countries in the Commonwealth, most of them former British colonies, 29 have anti-gay laws. But some parts of Africa are going in the opposite direction. In 2021, Angola revised its same-sex relationships law and banned discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Botswana's High Court decriminalized homosexuality in 2019. Mozambique and the Seychelles have also scrapped anti-LGBTQ laws in recent years. Back in Accra, Michael hopes Ghana will have a rethink.
My sexuality or what I do with my partner in the confines of my room does not extend to the doorstep of any homophobic individual. So they should learn to live and let live. That is all.
But if Ghana's anti-gay law is passed, LGBTQ people, including Michael, will need to decide whether to protest, continue to live in fear, or try and leave the country. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
It is getting harder and harder to voice any sort of dissent in China. In fact, Chinese authorities recently sentenced two of the country's best-known human rights activists to more than a decade in prison on charges of subversion. Sophie Luo Changshun is a Chinese activist. She's also the wife of one of the jailed dissidents, Deng Jiaxi. She lives in exile in New York and joins us. Your husband, Sophie, as well as fellow legal scholar Zhu Yurzhong, have been in detention for more than 3 years. They had a closed-door trial last year. On Monday, they were sentenced to 12 and 14 years, respectively. What were they found guilty of?
Subversion of the state power, both of them.
Subversion of state power. Can you help us understand what that actually means?
This crime is very ridiculous from my lawyer's point of view, because they didn't do anything to subvert this government.
As I said, your husband and his colleague have already been in detention for more than 3 years and yesterday sentenced to at least another dozen years each. What are conditions like for them in prison?
They are not allowed to have paper and pen. They don't have hot water. They sit in a small room without going outside. They eat every day only a soup of vegetable soup with a bun.
How has your husband dealt with that? I mean, do you think he's able to keep up his spirits?
Absolutely. Although they have no book to read, no pen and pencil to write, they write in their mind, in their freedom of thinking. They do meditation and doing exercise every day. They have a lot of ideas still.
Now, your husband, Deng Jiaxi, and his colleague, Luo Changshun, founded something called the New Citizens Movement. It advocates for a transition to democratic rule in China. Is it a real threat to Chinese authorities?
I think the original purpose is to do a transformation gradually, to let people's voice out to the government, let the government to do reformation and to improve the situation in China, to set up the civil society. But unfortunately, the government, especially the present government, this dictator, he is so idiot. He don't know these smart people is doing things for the benefit of people, for the benefit of the country's future. So they see it as a threat.
Is the ultimate goal, Sophie, of the New Citizens Movement to basically replace the current government of Xi Jinping?
Not necessarily. The New Citizens Movement target is to build for society, for every citizen to be a real citizen, but not a subject, to build up a healthy society.
The New Citizens Movement, from what you're saying, though, does basically paint a picture of the current government being wrong on a lot of things, and that seems like a fairly powerful charge to be making.
They always afraid the voice of people. Of course, as a dictator, they see it's dangerous to them.
Now, your husband, Deng Jiaxi, released a statement before the sentencing. What did it say?
The theme of it is dictatorship must go away from the stage of history. Democracy will win. And he believes if China continue to do autocracy, authoritarian, they will die for sure. What they promoted is peaceful, rational, and nonviolent.
Now, another one of your husband's colleagues, Xu Jiayong, also shared with you a letter before he was sentenced this week. What did his letter say?
He described a world he dreamed of, which was democracy, with freedom, with rule of law. He described in detail what does that mean. Both of them advocate people get rid of the dictatorship and build a country with freedom, democracy, and the rule of law.
Yeah, so both activists painting a very different future for China without dictatorship. Is there any chance of appeal or a reduced sentence?
Both of them, they will appeal, but I don't see any possibility to reduce their years. But for me, this is not so important anymore because I don't care about their sentence anymore. What I care is how shall I get rid of this authoritarian.
As I listen to you describe the letters and the final statements from your husband and from Xu Jiayong, they're advocating a very radically different vision for China, one that is dangerous to express in public. Do you have any sense of how many other people in China share their views?
That is the terrible, sad fact. It's not too many people in China really know Xu Jiayong and Ding Jiaxi.
So you're saying that people in China aren't even aware that your husband and his colleagues are making these statements?
That's true. Only the people that can climb the firewall, climb the censorship of the internet, only those people know what happened to these two people and what their real ideas are. In China, almost no people hear the voice. Many of my friends, when I check with them, they don't know. To be frankly saying, I'm so sad that not too many people know they are doing this kind of illegal things to put a legal citizen into jail.
Mm. Finally, Sophie, I gather the only way you have to communicate with your husband is through letters. I'm wondering if you would be able to share with us some of the thoughts you included in those letters to Ding Jiaxi. What do you tell him?
Oh, I tell him everything. I know my letters were monitored, but I still write whatever I want to say to him. I tell him what I experienced in detail after his detention, and I tell him every day what I think, I saw, I thought. My letter is a way for me to miss him. I always believe the heart communication. Because he can't write, I want him to hear my voice.
I was going to ask you how you keep your spirits up, but it sounds like letter writing is one of the ways.
Absolutely, you are right. Letter writing is one of my way to survive. For the first 3 years, when he is in the jail, his letter to me is my spiritual food. It's the happiness with friends and my thankfulness to friends made me survive today. And my husband's encouragement also.
Sophie Luo Shanchun is a Chinese activist. She's also the wife of one of China's best-known dissidents, Ding Jiaxi. Chinese authorities sentenced him to 12 years in prison this week. Sophie, thank you very much indeed for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.